I'm Peter O'Dowd, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support your NPR station at donate.npr.org/now. Here and Now helps you make sense of the world right now, the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of our lives, the transition to the Biden administration, and how that will change Washington and America and your hometown, and all the stories from around the country, the local and regional news that resonates everywhere. So make a donation today, and that investment will come right back to you. It is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump continues to claim that fraud caused him to lose the election. And now he's parted ways with his attorney general, William Barr, who said it didn't. Barr is going to be leaving the Justice Department next week. NPR's Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department. Attorney General Barr praised Donald Trump in his resignation letter. Did Barr resign or was he pushed out?
Well, from a conversation that I had with a source, what I understand is that this was basically an amicable joint decision. They came to a mutual agreement on a plan for Barr to leave. Now, that said, it's no secret that their relationship, which had once been fairly close, had grown frosty in recent weeks. Barr's statement that the Justice Department had looked into allegations of fraud in this election and that the department had found no evidence of widespread fraud that would change the outcome is obviously something that you referenced and that had angered the president. But it wasn't the only thing that had kind of caused this rift in the relationship. The president has been upset by the fact that there was no significant action from the Justice Department out of the investigation by John Durham into the origins of the Russia probe. That's something that the president certainly wanted to see big action on before the election. And then there's also the fact that the Justice Department is investigating President-elect Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, for potential tax crimes. News of that only came out last week. Another instance of something that the president wanted to see happen before the election and did not. And Trump has made his displeasure with all of that clear on Twitter and in public statements in the past couple of weeks.
Barr, though, has been on the president's side for a long time. He intervened in cases to help Trump associates Michael Flynn and Roger Stone. Back in June, he was said to have personally ordered the clearing of peaceful racial justice protesters in front of the White House so the president could hold a photo op at a church across the street. The attorney general is not supposed to be doing the president's personal bidding. Have those under him in the Justice Department supported his actions?
We have seen criticism from former Justice Department officials, certainly, of Barr's actions atop the Justice Department. We have seen letter after letter criticizing him for steps that he's taken, many of the things that you referenced, and calling on him to resign. Barr basically shrugged those off. What we have seen as well, though, in the past several months is actually current Justice Department officials, current federal prosecutors taking the highly unusual step of coming out and publicly criticizing the attorney general for actions that he's taken, saying that he has essentially politicized the department and he has kind of like knocked down the wall of independence that is supposed to exist between the department and the White House. And certainly in private conversations that one can have with folks inside the Justice Department, there is grumbling and discontent about how this attorney general has led the department.
The person who's going to be taking his place is Barr's number two, Jeffrey Rosen. He becomes acting attorney general for just the next month until the Biden administration begins. Is there a concern that President Trump might push the department to do more of his bidding in the remaining days in office, such as appoint a special counsel for the investigation that you mentioned into the taxes of Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden?
In terms of concern of the president pushing Jeffrey Rosen to take actions, we certainly know that the president has been pushing for, say, the release of classified intelligence related to the Russia investigation. And sources tell me that Barr has been instrumental in kind of keeping that at bay and pushing back on that. So that may be something that Rosen will face pressure on from the president. And certainly folks in the national security world are concerned about that. In terms of a potential special counsel for the investigation into Hunter Biden's taxes, there have been calls from Republicans on the Hill, particularly in the House, for the Justice Department to do that. Barr had not made any move on that as of now, obviously. Rosen, that's something that Rosen could do. He could also, we may see the current U.S. attorney in Delaware, which is leading that investigation, stay on into the Biden administration. But what this does for sure in terms of the Hunter Biden investigation is make it an issue going forward into the next administration.
And very briefly, President-elect Joe Biden has not named his pick yet for his own attorney general. We're hearing about former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. There is some pushback among Republicans on her. Any other names that have come up?
There are other names that have come up. Yates is certainly one of the front runners. Other leading names would be Senator Doug Jones, who recently lost his reelection in Alabama for his seat. He is a former federal prosecutor, someone who is on the list, as is Merrick Garland, a federal appeals court judge here in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Thanks.
Thank you.
How do you convince someone who is hesitant about a vaccine to get one? Well, pediatricians have a lot of experience fending off myths and conspiracies about vaccines. And with us to talk about some strategies is Dr. Nushin Aminuddin, a community pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic and the chairwoman of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mosley. I am thrilled to be talking with you today.
Yes. Well, before we get to the conversation about vaccine hesitancy, the current COVID-19 vaccines have been recommended for people 16 and older, not yet for younger children, because they haven't been included in the clinical trials. But why is that? When could we see young people get a vaccine?
Well, that's a great question. The American Academy of Pediatrics strongly encourages the FDA and CDC to include children in the trials because we know that children are a potentially vulnerable population. We've been fortunate that most children who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 have actually done pretty well with minimal to no symptoms, but a small proportion of those children have had a very serious outcome of multi-inflammatory system disease. So we want to make sure that they are included in later stages of the trial once we know it's safe to do so.
As I mentioned, pediatricians have conversations all the time with skeptical parents and caregivers. But with this vaccine, there's understandable nervousness. Before COVID-19, the fastest record for a vaccine development was for the mumps, and that took 4 years. How do you approach conversations with people who are very concerned about the effectiveness and side effects of this vaccine?
Well, that's a great question. For over a decade now, I have been working directly with families who've expressed hesitance or a refusal of vaccines. And number one, I think it's most important to build trust with them and to be what I call radically transparent, to let them know where good, solid, accurate sources of information are, and then over time, oftentimes, to build up that trust. I would tell parents at this point in time with a brand new vaccine that this is really the culmination of years, even decades of research. So even though it went through the system quickly, it's still passing through all the phases that we would put any normal vaccine through. And so I would also encourage them to talk with me about any concerns that they have and to understand that we are keeping very close track of vaccines. We do this as part of the general process of vaccines to ensure that they are safe and effective.
You have a few other strategies, and you give the example of the measles outbreak in Minnesota when vaccine rates had fallen in the Somali community after a targeted campaign by anti-vaccination activists. Tell us a little bit about what happened there and what strategies could be used this time around with this COVID vaccine.
Well, I think 3 years ago when we had this measles outbreak, the most important thing was to be able to partner with the community. And in the Somali community, where 15 years ago they had higher than average levels of vaccine uptake, we saw that decrease and be cut in half over a decade, unfortunately. So meeting the meeting the community where they are, making sure that trusted members of their community, elders, imams, who are spiritual and religious leaders, were part of our group. And using interpreters was key to ensuring that their questions were answered and that they were given accurate information rather than unfortunate misinformation, which had been shared and had proliferated through the community before. So I think understanding the community's concerns, being willing to listen and spend time, and also to leverage the community's own powerful oral tradition, which is so important in the Somali culture, to be able to share that information and make community members trusted sources of information for vaccine information.
What other recommendations do you have, not only for doctors and nurses and healthcare workers, but for everyday people who are beginning to have these conversations with folks who are really concerned?
Well, I think number one, you should be able to ask your physician or healthcare provider any question you have. We may not have all of the answers right now because it is a vaccine that is still rolling out, but we have decades of experience with the vaccine process, and I think we have an excellent track record of proving that vaccines are safe, that they are effective, and they save lives. And this process is going to continue. It's gone through all the appropriate stages, and we will continue to make sure that vaccine surveillance is continuing. That never stops.
That's Dr. Nusheen Aminuddin, a community pediatrician at the Mayo Clinic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for reaching out.
For world-renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma, music has been a source of solace during the pandemic. Early on, Ma tweeted videos of himself playing some of his pieces from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Musicians around the world responded with works of their own, using Ma's hashtag Songs of Comfort. This all sparked an idea for a new album. Yo-Yo Ma teamed up with a longtime friend, British pianist Catherine, or Kathy Stott, on a new collection, Songs of Comfort and Hope. It came out last week.
What we really wanted to do was to take songs that are probably deeply meaningful to different peoples around the world. Since this is a worldwide pandemic, and how do we actually address what people feel deeply all over the world.
So you looked internationally, and this is a traditional song that many people recognize from Simon and Garfunkel, but it has deeper roots than that. Let's listen to Scarborough Fair, and in particular, this great sound in the beginning of kind of a percussive plucking of the strings that you do here. Let's listen. Comfort in this song is the familiarity of it. What do you find in it?
Well, you know, we wanted to choose songs that people know and love from different places and from different times. You know, Scarborough Fair is a traditional English folk song, but Kathy had this great idea. She said, you know, why don't we actually, for some of the traditional songs, maybe we could also find really interesting arrangers to do it so that we can actually have a different sound. Like you were describing the beginning plucking the cello. And that's one way of kind of making these songs different, special, and contemporary.
Do you find comfort in this song, in your own kind of history?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, it's almost none of those songs we play or record without getting very misty-eyed. I mean, there's one reason why these songs are, you know, have lasted so long and mean so much to people.
When you think of a song like the Antonin Dvorak, a movement from his Symphony No. 9 from the New World, this is Going Home, and people may be surprised that it's a Dvorak song. He wrote it not long after he arrived in America in 1893 from what is now the Czech Republic. It's part of the second movement that took on new life, and let's hear a little bit of it now. When you listen to that now, what goes through your mind?
Oh my goodness, so much, because I think Dvorak was more than a composer, he was also a teacher. And the lyrics and the song Going Home was actually written by his student, William Arms Fisher. Dvorak taught for a couple of years at the National Conservatory of Music. He taught his students, don't compose like me, but listen to what's around you. His students heard him and then taught in the same way. And as a result, we have some of the most distinct, original voices that are American voices, but so diverse, as is the country.
And it's wonderful to think of, in terms of the lyrics, Dvorak did not write, going home, I'm a going home, quiet like, still someday, I'm just going home. And of course, when you think about the pandemic, many of us consider ourselves sort of stuck at home, if we're lucky enough to have a home. Yet the sentiment of longing is the common thread in many of these pieces. When you're playing them, where does that sentiment come from in you? I mean, I'm imagining that your life is a lot different right now than it has been, certainly in your performing career, because are you pretty much staying in one place?
I am. And what's amazing is that literally for the first time in my life, certainly in the last 45 years, I'm actually feeling what people who lead a regular life do, because my life has been anything but regular. And suddenly I actually go to the office, you know, like 9 to 5, Monday to Fridays. And I can't wait for the weekend sometimes and dread Monday. And look,
Welcome to the world.
Exactly. I work nights, you know, I'm one of those guys that work nights.
Just get a steady job, Yo-Yo.
Yeah, I'm looking for a regular job, a day job. But in terms of home, I think we all have so many different versions of home. Whether it's the home where we were born, and whether it's memories of home, memories of landscape, of foods, of smells, of scents. And then, of course, we're a country where people move. So home is much larger than a place or even our own memories.
And it's great to just be reminded of what provides comfort and solace to people around the world, no matter where you come from. And you have a song, Tula Baba. It's an African lullaby. We may not be familiar with this, but it's sung by a lot of choruses around the world. The lyrics are, hush, hush, little baby, daddy will be back in the morning. There's a star that will draw him home. What drew you to this song?
Well, so Kathy Stott, once again, knew this song, and she played it for one of her students who's from South Africa, and that student started crying and said, you know, this so reminds me of my childhood, because that's a song that we sang all the time. And it's a Zulu lullaby. And so coming home guided by the star is actually knowledge that the Zulus and also indigenous people have. They don't get lost because they read the skies. there's something else that Kathy and I hope that the music will kind of reach deep within people's psyches and memories to honor the people who are doing incredibly hard work and the people who have lost others, and kind of recapture the sense of caring that we have for one another. And, you know, we see incredible heroic acts, but at the same time, I think something in us has been kind of deadened, and we want to make sure that that part always is awake, because then we can build the wonderful society that we know we live in, and we just need to kind of recapture that part.
I think in terms of rebuilding and recapturing and a sense of restoration, I want to hear this song, which is really lovely. It's sort of, you did it in a jaunty, jazzy way. We'll Meet Again, a song recorded by Vera Lynn, a British singer, in 1939. In fact, she just died this year. And she sang it with a sense of heartbreak and hope. And you and Catherine, who just plays so beautifully, take a different approach. Yo-Yo playing that, did you feel like you were bringing us to the next chapter, to the point when we can meet again?
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, because I think one of the things we thought about is that this song was played during the separation of loved ones during the war, during the Second World War. And so many of these songs deal with that kind of separation. We hope we'll meet again. There's the hope, but there's also the possibility that we won't meet again. We did want to end the album on a hopeful note, but it's also a poignant note.
Well, I think we're lucky to have a musical soundtrack from other times to add to this time, from you, Yo-Yo Ma, and Catherine Stott. So nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Lisa, it's great to speak with you. Really, we enjoy what you do every day.
Catherine Stott's new album is Songs of Comfort and Hope. This is Here and Now.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
The oil giant ExxonMobil has released a 5-year plan to address climate change. The company says it will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but there are questions about how and whether it will appease activist investors who want ExxonMobil to do more. Let's talk about this now with Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you, Lisa?
Good. First, explain Exxon's plan. It doesn't exactly reduce greenhouse gas emissions from its products. Instead, it reduces the emissions intensity of its oil production. What does that mean?
It's incrementalism. I mean, it's a bit derivative. So, and you could argue that that's big progress for a behemoth that has traditionally lagged on climate leadership. So, for example, reducing emissions intensity of production means pulling back on flaring methane, a byproduct of drilling that's an especially destructive greenhouse gas. So there's a whole world of energy intensity to production and exploration, their tankers, their pipelines, their trucks, their flares. But what about the 80% of company emissions in the form of what is ultimately sold to customers? So for the time being, Exxon is de-emphasizing that.
So the issue is whether investors are going to be happy with that. It sounds like there are roughly two camps of shareholders. One camp wants ExxonMobil to reduce emissions without rocking the boat too much, and the other one wants the company to move faster to cut emissions. How are the interests playing out? What kind of pressure are they applying to Exxon?
Well, time was with traditional investors and value investors, you can be all in fossil fuels. So the oil price collapses, you slash capital spending, you starve the market, supply and demand meet up again, and prices shoot up and you enjoy fat profits. So you witness what happened between the late 90s and oil shooting up to $140 a barrel in 2008. Now you have a whole new overlap of investors saying you need to self-disrupt because it makes most business and ecological sense. You ignore alternative energy and wholesale carbon reduction at the great peril of what you will have to look like in just a few years. And then how safe is your dividend going to be?
And so are the investors pulling out, some of them?
Well, there are some out there that are saying, increasingly, vociferously, that it's not enough if you follow activists, especially, you know, abroad. One critic put it this way: while the European peers, they're beginning to come to terms with the reality that Paris calls for absolute reduction in fossil fuels, one Exxon critic is saying Exxon is offering, you know, cutting production by a million barrels per day over the next 5 years, calling that the thinnest of fig leaves. These are new critics at the table.
Exxon is one of the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases in the world, along with other big oil companies. How does its climate plan stack up against those of other companies who've also made some kind of a commitment to reducing emissions?
Yeah, it's been argued that some of Exxon's global rivals, BP and Shell, stand out especially. They are getting ahead in terms of the urgency of this backdrop. But the whole school of activists is critical of all of these multinationals together, saying they got fat for decades and now they're kind of belatedly getting religion.
And the pandemic seems to have accelerated the drive for cleaner energy. But I wonder, when it's over and economies rev up again, how profitable fossil fuels are going to be compared to profits from cleaner energy.
So much, Lisa, depends on the longer term price of crude oil. Is $50 the new $75, which was the new $100? Remember when $30 oil used to be called the price spike? How much less are we going to use in our car and jetliners in the Zoom normal? How quickly will the gas pump be replaced with charging stations? Critically, when will nations add a real cost to carbon intensity? These are all very costly questions.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
The Islamist terrorist group Boko Haram is claiming responsibility for the kidnapping of more than 300 students from a boys' school in Nigeria on Friday, and most of the children are still missing. Boko Haram is accused of killing thousands and displacing more than a million people in their campaign to overthrow the Nigerian government and create an Islamic state. And after a decade-long investigation, the International Criminal Court says there's now enough evidence to investigate the group for war crimes and crimes against humanity. The BBC's Myeni Jones joins us now from a shaky Skype line from northern Nigeria. And Myeni, tell us more about what happened last Friday at this boarding school.
Yes, so we went to the town where the attack took place. It's called Kankara. It's in northwest Nigeria, just a small town surrounded by countryside. And the school is quite isolated and only had two security guards. We spoke to a couple of boys who managed to escape, and they told us that some armed gunmen rode into the school campus late on Friday night, waving AK-47s and gathered a number of them with them. We're not sure on the numbers yet. Some of the boys were able to escape before being captured. They jumped the wall of the school and hid in the neighboring countryside. However, one eyewitness told us that he counted 520 boys. He then escaped later, and the state government is saying that over 300 boys are still missing.
Boko Haram, which roughly translates to Western education is forbidden, has killed more than 36,000 people and displaced millions. Is this claim of responsibility by Boko Haram credible?
It's really hard to tell at this stage. Boko Haram is traditionally active in a different part of the country in the northeast. If their claim is true, that shows that they are spreading their area of activity into other parts of Nigeria towards the northwest, and that could be quite worrying. It shows that they have more power. On the other side, there are many people who say that Abubakar Shekau, the head of Boko Haram, is always seeking publicity, and one of the reasons he's claiming this attack is because it's gotten so much media coverage, and he wants to give the impression that his faction of Boko Haram is more powerful than it actually is. So we are not sure yet if he's actually behind this terror group, particularly as this would be the first time they act in this region. But if it's true, it's very worrying.
Boko Haram was responsible for a kidnapping in 2014 that made world headlines. Aren't some of those young women who were part of that kidnapping still missing?
About half of the girls who were kidnapped in 2014, the famous Chibok girls who got the attention of the world, including then First Lady Michelle Obama, many of them are still missing, and a number of them are believed to be dead. So when this incident happened, because of the scale of it, hundreds of boys being taken in the middle of night, it really brought back to mind the attack, the fates of some of those girls, the fact that their parents never heard from them again, that this won't be happening to their sons this time around.
What is being done to find these missing students that went missing on Friday?
So the governor of Katsina State, which is the state in North Korea where the attack took place on Friday, released a statement on Twitter last night saying that the authorities were negotiating with the armed men who took the boys. Now, this was before Boko Haram claimed responsibility, and they haven't said anything. The government hasn't said anything since that claim has been made. Many here are worried because they believe that negotiating with jihadis, potentially paying a ransom to some of these terror groups, just encourages them to carry out these types of attack further. Another large-scale attack on a boarding school happened in 2018. So people want to see less of this and not more, and they're worried that the government may be negotiating with terrorists.
That's the BBC's Mayeni Jones, who's joining us from northern Nigeria. Thank you so much for this update.
Thanks.
As Congress continues to stall on extending federal aid to communities hard hit by this pandemic, nonprofits are stepping up to meet the needs of people. But many of those charities are also struggling. Rip Rapson is president and CEO of the Kresge Foundation, and he's been rethinking how nonprofits operate in this crisis. The Kresge Foundation is a private philanthropy based in the Detroit area that operates nationally, and we should note it is a supporter of NPR. Rip, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes. So from your perspective as a leader in philanthropy, how dire is the situation in our country right now?
Oh, my. It's impossible to overstate. And I think if you view it through the lens simply of a pandemic-driven recession, it would be bad enough. But I think because it was also accompanied by this massive rupture around racial justice, we are looking at a situation that is, from the perspective of a privately endowed philanthropy, sort of pushes all of our levers of concern and kind of calls on all of our possible uses of institutional capital.
Mm. Pushing all of those levers, what are the levers? What's changing in the strategy you use in deciding who gets help and who doesn't?
Mm. For a private philanthropy, 6 months ago was such a clarion call to just step up and be there in the moment. You know, aggregate money around health needs, around keeping nonprofits afloat, helping childcare centers stay open, helping small businesses keep their employees. And it wasn't much more complicated than that. It was just, how do you do that quickly? And I think we've seen that in almost every city across the country. I think the response has been effective, but we also have to do more. But doing more is hard. We're financially constrained just the way anybody else is, and it just involves our digging a little deeper, being a little more thoughtful, and realizing that there are some trade-offs, that we've just got to pull some of our effort forward and into high gear.
Yeah. Knowing that we are living through a public health crisis and there will continue to be needs in the months and years ahead, how do you balance short-term and long-term giving?
The short-term giving can't go on indefinitely. We really have to figure out a way of delivering health services, economic support services, educational services, housing services, the whole gamut of community need in a very different way. And I actually think, Tanya, that's one way in which Detroit might actually have something to say to the broader communities of the country, because we in some ways went through this in the bankruptcy of, you know, 7, 8, 10 years ago, where our private sector had bottomed out, our public sector was being indicted, our nonprofit sector was sort of hanging on by a thread, and philanthropy had to step into the void. And I think we learned a lot about what that looks like. But over the long term, we had to figure out a different way of sort of cracking these really tough problems and build our way slowly, slowly, slowly back to solvency and health and vitality. And I think the big question here is whether you can pull the different sectors back into a different role and relationship. And I think that when we come out the other side of COVID and however many months it will be, I think our decision-making machinery has to look different. Private sector has some tools, the philanthropic sector has some tools, the public sector has some tools, and we have to figure out a way to sort of stitch those together to create sort of a greater capacity to take on issues that I think are just going to be so weighty and so painful unless we do.
But as I mentioned earlier, though, Congress also has the tools, but they've been unable to come up with a deal. It seems that the humanitarian appeal to provide relief to people struggling during the pandemic has not worked. Is there another way, from your view, another case to be made to compel members of Congress to act?
In some ways, the unit of government that is the least well-resourced, local governments, are actually working in ways that have kept our communities afloat. And I must admit, for the life of me, I do not understand why the moral argument coupled with the argument of efficacy, that they're actually getting things done, isn't enough to free up resources to help make that job easier. We're talking ultimately about the residents of our communities. And municipal government can only do this for so long. So I'm hoping that it's sort of the two-step, that it's a moral imperative and it's a practical imperative. This is the only way we're going to move communities forward.
Rip Rapson, president and CEO of the Kresge Foundation, a private national institution based in the Detroit area. Rip, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you, Tanya.
So maybe you've been cloistered at home for the last 8 months, all day, working, attending class, everything at home. If you've got a lovable four-legged creature by your side, that may provide some comfort, or not. Pets are having to get used to our new routines and the disruption of theirs. Case in point, when the owner of the tuxedo cat, Frankie, brought two new pandemic kittens to their home in Rhode Island, Frankie's response was unambiguous. In Massachusetts, a lab hound mix named Ebony has figured out a way to get the attention of her humans, who seem to be around all the time now. Dr. Stephanie Bornsweil has heard it all. She's a veterinary behaviorist at Tufts University's Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine in Grafton, Massachusetts. Dr. Bornsweil says she's been swamped with pet peeves in these pandemic times.
The new problem that I'm seeing more than anything else is barking. Even people whose pets have a whole bunch of other problems, the main concern now is barking because it's getting in the way of people being able to do their work.
That's right, if you have a barking dog in the background. But why are they barking more?
Partly they're not barking more. People are just with their barking dogs more. So dogs, you know, one common reason why dogs bark is territorial. They hear people come to the door. There's delivery trucks, things like that. There are a whole lot more delivery trucks.
So when dogs bark a lot and seek attention more, what can you do? Do you isolate them or do you do just the opposite?
First of all, you want to find out, is it a learned behavior? Are they doing it because when they bark at you, you stop and you pet them or you give them a treat to get them to be quiet? Or is it because they're actually needy and lonely or need something? Or is it territorial barking? If they're barking a lot out the window, it can help to just close the door to the front room so they're not looking out the window. You also want to give them something to do, so a food puzzle toy, something nice to chew. You want to make sure they've had plenty of exercise, especially if they're missing out on their usual time at a dog park or at a daycare. Then you want to ignore the unwanted behavior. But ignoring can be really hard because if you're in the middle of a meeting, you can't just say, I have to let my dog bark until he stops. So that's why you really want to make sure that you get your dog set up with something really enjoyable to do while you're on your meeting.
I like the idea of having something to do and something to chew on, because it sounds very much like what we humans need as well. In terms of cats, what are you seeing there?
So with cats, too, it's very similar. You can strike a compromise with your cat. If your cat wants to be close to you, you can put a nice comfy place right next to the computer and then reinforce them with some treats for laying down in the place where you want them to lay and not in the place where you don't want them to lay, which is right on your keyboard with their rear end up against the screen camera. But again, you also have to exercise your cat. Some cats enjoy puzzle toys. So for young cats, you can set them up with a puzzle toy or throw out some bird seed in front of their window seat and they can watch all the birds come. What I think of as cat theater. I think a critical piece is making sure that you're consistent with the pets, because if you're going to pet the dog sometimes when they interrupt in a meeting and bark and not other times, they're getting a mixed message. And same with the cat. Predictability is everything for them. And when we change all the rules, like with COVID, it can make them very uneasy and very confused.
You're talking mostly, I think, about animals that have been part of families for quite some time. What about pandemic pets, people who have recently acquired a cat or a dog or a bird or whatever? Are you seeing kind of rescuers regret or buyers regret?
This is one of the problems that isn't quite a problem yet, that's going to be a problem when people go back into the world. Dogs and cats that have never spent more than 5 minutes alone, what's going to happen when their people suddenly go back to work full time?
And what can you do to prepare them for that?
I think one of the things you can do, which it's kind of ironic, since the beginning of the pandemic, I've been telling people, be sure to go out for a walk without your dog. Be sure to take time away from your cat. I don't have the data for cats, but a dog that spends no time alone is at high risk for developing separation anxiety later. They need to develop that independence and stand on their own 4 feet. I would anticipate what I'm going to see next is a spike of problems when dogs that were insufficiently socialized during the pandemic are going out in the world and reaching social maturity. On the other hand, I anticipate seeing some really good stuff too. There's nothing like spending a lot of time with an animal to really get an understanding of what their life is like on a daily basis, what the rhythm of their days are like. Another good thing is I think we're going to come out of this with all of us having a much deeper understanding of the importance of social connection and mental stimulation for our pets.
And if our pets are spending enrichment time, then we're more enriched by having them.
Absolutely. I don't think I could have gotten through the pandemic without my dogs.
Well, really nice to speak with you. Thank you for all your help. Stephanie Bornsweil, veterinary behaviorist and clinical assistant professor at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. Thank you so much, Dr. Bornsweil.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.